I'm going to talk tonight about new thinking in Christian education and then use that as the foundation tomorrow for going on into the problem of resetting our sights in Christian education. Well, now, first, I want to take three key words and discuss the way in which they are used in Christian education, and then move on to three other words that automatically get themselves reinterpreted, although they are traditional words, because of the use of these first three. And the first of these words is dialogue. I suppose the word has been popularized mostly in Christian education circles by Reuel Howe, who builds his treatment of dialogue out of the background of what he calls the language of relationships. Howe is convinced that words obtain their meaning as far as currency for communication is concerned against the background of what happens to people when they hear these words. In what relationship is the word used? And so dialogue is the attempt to understand communication against the background of the language of relationships. And he calls dialogue that address and response between persons in which there is a flow of meaning between them in spite of all the obstacles that would normally block that relationship. Dialogue, then, is a kind of communication, a kind of give and take, where each one hears what the other one is saying and what the other one means. It also involves an understanding of interpersonal relationships very similar to what Martin Buber talks about in I and Thou. And the key to this is not grasping a method of relationships or a method of dialogue, but actually the achieving of the relationship. And this can even happen in lectures. When Martin Buber lectures, the lecture hall is filled to overflowing and dialogue occurs. The same thing happens when Reuel Howe lectures. It doesn't have to be the actual words going back and forth. What seems to be a dialogue can be the exchange of two monologues. We see this oftentimes when a pastor attempts to teach a confirmation class. Then the second word is engagement. And this word has been used most recently and effectively by David Hunter in a little book called Christian Education as Engagement. And this is a word that seeks to deepen the meaning of the usual theological terms encounter or meeting. It's possible for two trains on the same track to encounter each other. But I'm not sure this is what the divine human encounter is likely to be. Two automobiles meet in an intersection and one or the other or both may be destroyed. But the word engagement means an intertwining, an involving, a response with some kind of flow in both directions. And this word engagement, you see, as it's spelled out, is in terms of what we might call a logic of self-involvement, where the words that are used are performance words rather than logical structures, words which reflect feelings of attitudes and emotions, what we call feeling-revealing behavior. When Jacob wrestles, this is a violent encounter, but it's still engagement. Wrestling is always an engagement. You're all twisted up together. When Jeremiah has an engagement with God, the response is in terms of obedience. There's an engagement of a group in the story of Pentecost, where the gospel is communicated to many. And the interesting thing is that in this engagement, nobody gave his intellectual assent. The Bible tells us they were cut to the quick, cut to the heart, and then said, "What can we do?" This is dialogue. This is engagement. This is more and deeper than what the word encounter can possibly mean. And then the third word that is important, I think, in our understanding of Christian education today is the creative use that's been made of the old Greek term kerygma. For kerygma tells us that there is a difference between two ways of presenting the gospel, as proclamation or as didactic teaching. The important thing, in other words, is to tell the story. And when we tell the story, something is likely to happen. The most interesting and I think the most significant development of this has been in the thinking of men like Father Sloyan of Catholic University with his book called Modern Catechetics and his earlier book, Shaping the Christian Message, or in the Symposium in Religious Education on Kerygmatic Catechetics by Jerry Sloyan and others. But here you're saying you take the catechism, and Lutherans as well as Roman Catholics need to get this. You take a catechism and you give it to the teacher. You never give it to the child. The important thing is for the child to hear the story. The catechism is to help the teacher summarize the story after it's been heard. But the real teaching is in the storytelling. Telling the story that the Bible tells about the mystery of God's working with man. And this never can be reduced to a proposition without emasculating the truth. And it's interesting the different ways in which people approach storytelling. Marcus Bart wrote an article called The Cowboy in the Sunday School. And his point was that the unvarnished Bible story, told without any attention to biblical scholarship or anything else, is the only way in which the truth of the gospel gets through to anybody. David Hunter, operating in terms of engagement, a quite different perspective from Marcus Bart theologically, says that the story is what leads to engagement. It's becoming involved in the story that the Bible tells that makes all the difference in terms of the meaning of one's life. Moving at storytelling from an entirely different angle is Professor Braithwaite of Oxford, who says you can tell any story. It doesn't make a difference whether it's true or false. You tell any story in order to stimulate moral action. And the real religious use of a story is to tell it to get moral results. Paul Van Buren, in his Secular Meaning of the Gospel, says that you tell the story that the Bible tells not to get moral results, not in order to convert, but simply to set men free as Christ sets men free. But every one of these men, in spite of the different theological perspective and educational end, comes back finally to the significance of the kerygma, the story, just as you find it in the best thinking in Roman Catholic circles with the kerygmatic catechetics. And if we take these three words, dialogue, engagement, and kerygma, seriously, it causes us to rethink to a certain extent three other very common words, the first of which is curriculum. Or we say the curriculum should be content-centered, some of us, or Bible-centered, or church-centered, or God-centered, or child-centered, but almost always in terms of some kind of a substantive center. Now, if you take dialogue seriously and engagement seriously, you may use any one of these as one of your centers at any time, but it's never enough. The real center of any curriculum is what happens to the pupil. And what happens to the pupil depends upon the religious issues in his life, not the religious issue described in a textbook. And a religious issue can be any kind of a decision. There can be religious significance in whether or not a wife throws out the garbage, whether someone chooses a new suit, whether one decides no longer to drink non-calorie Cokes to stay thin because they don't know what will happen because of the calcimate that's in it. They read Consumers Union and make decisions that has religious significance sometimes. Any kind of decision-making can be a religious issue in someone's life. And the important thing is to understand how you make these decisions. What pressures come on you? Is it because of what the gang thinks? Is it because of what your parents taught you? Is it because of what the church says? Is it because of the fact simply that you're afraid to break the law because you might get caught? The religious significance of decision-making is determined in terms of how one makes his decisions. And if the religious issues are at the center of the curriculum, all of the resources are drawn together to help us reflect on the religious issues in our lives. The curriculum then becomes the pupil's world, in which the teacher and the pupils tell stories of their lives to each other. For education is what happens to a person in a community. Another word that gets altered a bit by this approach is the word mission. For a number of years now, people have been saying the church is mission. The church is a lot of other things, but the church is mission. It's become a cliche. But most of our children still think that when you say anything about mission, you mean some poor guy living out in some country with the wild Indians or the so-called natives, whatever they are, anywhere but at home. But once you say the church is mission, you recognize that Jesus Christ came to save the world, including the world around me. And you realize that an apostle is one who is sent forth from this congregation, not just one that's sent forth from this denomination, but he's sent out into the world, and the world begins right now. So that the problem of mission is the problem of the church itself, which Richard Niebuhr describes as the increase of the love of God and of neighbor. and we don't select our neighbor. Our neighbor may be the guy who lives next door. It may be the man we meet on the street. It can be a friend. It can be an enemy. And if the church is mission, and I'm a member of the church, then I must see Christ in my neighbor, whom I do not select. And because of this, I can have dialogue with other people. There can be engagement in mutual projects across all kinds of faith lines. And the important thing is that in this, the kerygma, from time to time, may be heard and responded to. And this is mission. And another word that gets revised by all of this thinking is the word world. We talk about the church against the world. But that means that the world is society organized apart from God. But now today, if we take seriously the meaning of the word creation and say that this is my Father's world, then the use of the word world theologically takes on a whole new meaning. It provides a framework of the doctrine of creation in which we understand that dialogue and engagement can occur. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I suppose, in a very sophisticated way, has developed this idea that the Christian is a Christian only as he lives in the world. And this is what he means by the secular element of the gospel. Or as Dean Johnson of Yale Divinity School puts it, the unavoidable primal fact is that the church is in the world and the world is in the church. In fact, the world is where God located his church. And the world is where we find the religious issues which stand at the very center of the curriculum of Christian education. These then are the six words that serve as background for some of the other things that I want to say tonight. And perhaps the most important movement that we have to look at is the theology of the laity, this whole rediscovery of a lay apostolate, which cuts across all the so-called barriers of communication between the various communions of Christendom. And you discover that in Roman Catholic circles, Lutheran circles, Episcopal circles, everywhere else, there are books on the meaning of the laity. And to show how the lines cross, the best books by Episcopalians are published by the Presbyterian Westminster Press. Moves back and forth this way. And it grows out, I think, of this emphasis on the meaning of the world as God's creation. Because as we look at the nature of the church and see it described as the people of God, we have here the root meaning of laity, laos. And one is introduced into or initiated into this ministry of the laity by his baptism. And then he becomes one who shares in the ministry of Christ to the world. This is the royal priesthood, shared by the ordained and the laity alike. And once one is in this position of recognizing that he has a ministry, he also recognizes that he has been given various gifts. And some are called because of their gifts to serve in one way and some to serve in another. But all of them for the same purpose, which is translated, I think, most effectively in the New English Bible, to equip God's people for a work in his service. Now, this significance of the laity is well described, I think, in a passage from the Evanston Reports of 1954. And I quote, "In daily living and work, the laity are not mere fragments of the church who are scattered about in the world and who come together again for worship and instruction, and specifically Christian fellowship on Sundays. They are the church's representatives, no matter where they are. It is the laity who draw together work and worship. It is they who bridge the gulf between the church and the world. And it is they who manifest in word and action the lordship of Christ over the world which claims so much of their time and energy and labor. This and not some new order or organization is the ministry of the laity. They are called to it because they belong to the church, although many do not yet know that they are thus called. For example, a man does not say, 'I am a Christian and also a politician,' but 'as a Christian, I fulfill my ministry as a politician. Or as Francis Ayres puts it in that remarkable book of his called The Ministry of the Laity, he says simply, you have a ministry. Therefore, fulfill your ministry. And you fulfill this ministry partly in terms of occupation, but fundamentally in terms of wherever you are in the world. As Gibson Winter has made clear, the most important place to fulfill one's ministry is in the very centers of power. Gibson Winter suggests that you can't do that if you live in the suburbs and go to a suburban church when all the power centers are in the center of town. And unless somehow there's a ministry that operates through City Hall, through the economic activities, through the expression of citizenship, there is no genuine ministry to one's society. Work, leisure, play, citizenship, witnessing against unjust laws, asserting God's claim on all men, accepting responsibility for the welfare of one's neighbor, are all part of this ministry of the laity. For ever since Cain, we know that we are our brother's keeper. This emphasis on the ministry of the laity also helps us to distinguish between what has been called the work of the church and church work. Church work is what might be abbreviated as ecclesiastical housekeeping, those that took care of the church's hardware. And there are many clergy who thoroughly exhaust the ministry of the laity in some kind of ecclesiastical plumbing society in the parish house. Now, there is a ministry of the laity that involves ecclesiastical housekeeping, but the basic ministry of the laity within the church as church work is the ministry of teaching, which equips one's fellows for service in the world, so that the work of the church becomes one's ministry in the world. And oftentimes the church as an organization has to make this distinction, and I think it has to say to its lay people, stay out of the church building. Your job is to witness elsewhere. Oftentimes it's saying to members of a family, don't send your members of the family out one by one to the church meetings on various nights of the week. Stay home and be a family. The church probably does a better job of tearing asunder those whom God has joined together than almost any other institution, because we don't have ways for families to be together in the church, and the church doesn't encourage them to stay home and be families there, because we're doing what so many preachers say when they talk about, oh yes, we have a ministry of the laity, look how I use my laity. And by the very phrase, they betrayed the fact that the layman is an it rather than a thou. Well, now, once we become terribly concerned about this ministry of the laity, it leads to all kinds of things that happen in the field of adult education. The most important example of this, I suppose, is the rise of the evangelical academies in Germany since the war. They are able to reach people that the churches cannot reach, and they reach them almost entirely with the one question, how can I be a responsible person in the world in which I live? I spent a weekend at Lockham with Dr. Hans Bilewski, and at that meeting, there were 150 civil servants, postmasters, mayors of small towns, various others in civil service positions, all of them searching to find what it meant to be a responsible Christian citizen. Most of them wouldn't go near the church. Many of them didn't go to the chapel service. But at the end of the evening, at 10 or 10:30 at night, after they'd heard all kinds of talk from their fellows, not from somebody who was ordained, they sat around over their bottles of beer and talked and smoked and talked about the religious issues in their lives. They didn't know they were being the church in that place, because they identified the church with an institution that was not related to their lives. But here was the stimulus for a ministry of the laity. In Canada, the United Church of Canada has 5 such lay centers, all the way from Naramata out in British Columbia to the East Coast. And again, they are dealing with the problem of the ministry of the laity with one weakness. They brag about the number of laymen who come to their schools and end up studying for the ordained ministry. And one of the best ways to ruin a good layman is to put a collar on him. Then in our own country, where we have not done very well with the model of the lay academy or even the Canadian type school, we've done an awful lot in the field of adult education, although it's only starting. In my own communion in the Episcopal Church, we say there's not any use really doing a job of Christian education unless we have classes for parents. And their parents' classes galore, proliferating all over the country, where they are asking the question, what is the ministry of a parent as a layman? What is the ministry of a parent in relation to infant baptism? What is the ministry of a parent if Horace Bushnell is right, that the parents have done half of all they ever can do for a child's religious development by the time a child is three? That's even before the nursery teacher gets in and begins to straighten out the parents and the child. Half the damage or half the good is already done. And the church has more or less abdicated in terms of this whole area of the ministry to the baby and the young child, where all this work in formation of character is done. And parents' classes help at least to come to an understanding of the ministry at this point. There's a church in England that goes at it from an entirely different angle, and they say the main job is to get people together in the congregation who are asking about their ministry in their jobs. A little different from the approach of the lay academies. A group of doctors, for example, 8 or 10 doctors, will meet together weekly for 8 or 10 or 12 weeks asking this question and recognizing that nobody can answer the question except doctors in dialogue who then engage in the ministry in and through the practice of medicine. Nurses, mothers, secretaries, apprentices on various types of jobs in England where they still have the apprentice system,
ditch diggers, anything you name, there is possible in a large church to have a small group of those with the same outlook and the same problems who, because of the dialogue and the concern and the engagement, begin to hear among themselves how the kerygma speaks to the religious issues in their lives. And it can only be done, I think, when there is not a mixture of occupations. And in most cases, the clergyman is the most ignorant member who would be present, and it's better that he stay away. He just doesn't understand this situation unless he's an ex-doctor or an ex-jockey or whatever it is that these groups happen to be. Then there's the problem of the layman in the church. And there are many groups here where you have Bible study and prayer groups and so forth. And above all, you have the concern groups. Groups that do come together because they share mutual concerns about the welfare of their community, the welfare of children, the problem of schools, or simply the satisfaction of reading important and controversial books that will stimulate them to think theologically and to reflect theologically upon the religious issues in their lives. And they discover there are no easy answers. And in all of this approach to the theology of the laity, there's something new, but it's basically old. It's basically the statement of the psalmist. Unless the Lord build the house, its builders toil thereon in vain. Unless the Lord keep the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. In vain do you rise up early and stay up late and eat hard-earned bread. So he gives his loved ones sleep. Another entirely different area of new thinking about Christian education is in the field of social responsibility. A number of years ago, 3 years ago I guess it was, the Religious Education Association had its convention, and we had a seminar on
contemporary American morality and nuclear war.
And it was one of the poorest attended of all the seminars. Everybody went to seminars on moral formation or on the use of the Bible or on juvenile delinquency, but nobody wanted to touch this one. In fact, the only article we had on the subject was one that was written by request by John Bennett, who is now the president of Union Theological Seminary, one of the few contemporary American theologians who's done any thinking on this subject. And then the editorial board discovered we hadn't had any articles on the subject. Nobody was writing in and saying, here's what we ought to do about Christian education and nuclear war. And then finally, there came to my notice a conference by a group of Jesuit theological students at West Baden, Indiana. On their own, they put on a nuclear war institute. And they got Father Clifford Kossel from out in the West Coast. And they got one of the Russian embassy boys from Washington and two or three others, including Christopher Hollis, an outstanding ex-Anglican Roman Catholic layman who writes for English papers. And Hollis was the one who really caught hold of this thing. And he recognized from the beginning that there is no such thing as a simple answer. You find simple answers to the nuclear war issues only in typical Sunday school materials or among certain political campaigners. Otherwise, the answer is very complex. And one of the reasons I think nobody will touch it is that anybody with moral insight usually doesn't have the scientific insight to go with it to dare to say anything. And Christopher Hollis recognized this. And so he talked about the various alternatives, but came to no set conclusions. But at least he brought in the religious issues on which people could meditate. And the conclusion was the only certainty, and that is that we are in the hands of God. And this is true, nuclear bomb or no nuclear bomb. And he called for responsible Christian leadership in this area. In other words, all we've done here is to make a beginning. We haven't done much more than ask the question. And I haven't found anybody writing a follow-up article
for Christopher Hollis. Just nothing's being done here. And it seems to me this is one of the great vacuums where we've been able to bring a little bit in because we happened to pick up the information about one conference out in Indiana. And fortunately, this material is made available to the editor.
And once we start thinking about social responsibility, there are a number of other issues that come into the picture where we're just beginning to do some thinking. I wonder how many of us have thought very creatively about what automation is doing to Christian education. What are the religious issues in the life of a person who is thoroughly and completely automated for 8 hours a day? This is more than the old assembly line. This is something you see that goes beyond that. It's where the actual work, the creative part of it, is done by the machine. And it means also what we call technological unemployment. It means that a person is reduced to a statistic. And even when he makes out his income tax, he's now identified by his social security number rather than by his name. The whole of our society, you see, is doing this sort of thing to us. And on the surface, it looks bad. And it is bad if we don't recognize what's happening and see where the interpersonal relationships are involved and how they can be strengthened and enriched.
And yet there's another side to the question. Again, an article in Religious Education, this time by Mother Mary Clark of Manhattanville, on America's new leisure arising out of automation.
And she calls it America's challenge to industry.
And it ties in again, you see, with your ministry of the laity. So your concern for the individual at this point involves the ones who feel automated and depersonalized.
Also those who are technologically unemployed and can't be retrained. But also there's the question, not only how do we help them at that point, but how do we help them with the resulting leisure time
that comes not only to them, but to many others because of an automated society.
Then another entirely different kind of question that again arises out of social responsibility and concern for individuals is, what do we do with exceptional people? What did you in your Sunday school program
for school dropouts?
What kind of a program do you have for the retarded or the handicapped? Well, in the first place, when you start thinking about the retarded or the handicapped and to some extent the dropouts, you're talking about a very small number of people, statistically speaking. Maybe of all the children in a given town, only 3% will be sufficiently retarded or handicapped that they need special attention, which means they can't come to Sunday school. They can't receive any Christian education. They can't be fitted into a class. Or they can't run their wheelchairs up and down the stairs of the average parish hall that's only been built with people who've never had a heart attack and have two strong legs and can run up and down stairs all day long. Even churches are built that way, so nobody can come in a wheelchair. And so here you have all these people where there's no material. No one denomination could ever spend the money to develop the material. All the churches in town can't put in the proper kinds of ramps. Most of us can't find or train the specialist teachers that are needed. What do we do? And there's just beginning to develop now a concern about this. Again, the first articles that have come in to me have been by a Roman Catholic sister out in California, Sister Miriam Exilium. I now have an article by a couple of Protestant doctors. This is next March's issue of Religious Education I'm talking about now. There's just been a conference on the Christian education, or the religious education, of the mentally retarded under the sponsorship of a Jewish rabbi. And those papers will come to me for examination, and the advance report is that at least one of them is worth publishing. So that we will have something on this next spring. But what we know now is that there are no adequate materials for the mentally retarded or handicapped. That the materials we have are almost always upper middle class materials for healthy kids who are about average in intelligence. Also, we might say just in passing, we have no materials whatever for the exceptional child who is gifted. In fact, the difficulty is to find teachers smart enough to teach them anything. But the average IQ of the average Sunday school teacher, you know what happens to the average boy who comes into that class with 150 IQ. There's just no comparison here. And so we have nothing really for the gifted child. What do you do with the child in Sunday school who comes and takes the book that's supposed to take a whole year and goes home and reads it Sunday afternoon before the football game begins on TV? And there are youngsters 8, 9, 10 years old that read that fast. Then they get bored, and by Christmas they quit Sunday school. And we have no way of reaching them. And as far as I know, at this point, nobody's tried to do anything. We've been concerned about the retarded. We haven't even given a thought to the gifted. And then we have another area, the area that I call the culturally deprived. And this picks up a whole group, a number of different groups. The youngsters in the inner city, the ones that wouldn't know what a sheep looked like, even if you drew a picture of it, who wouldn't have any idea whatever of what a shepherd was, where you couldn't even talk about palm leaves. They'd never seen palm leaves. Palms don't grow in New York City. Who would have no cultural background for understanding the pictures of family life in most of our materials. Who wouldn't understand why there's a father present. Most of them have the idea that most families are like the Christmas crèche. Mother and the baby, and father so far in the background you can't find him. Maybe there's the one place we could do something about some of the culturally deprived families. But we have nothing, you see, that speaks to them. Or take your isolated, rural whites, the kind that are even more deprived than your inner city migrants and Negroes. And what do you do there with our typical white Anglo-Saxon Protestant material with New England pictures of snow at Christmas time when they live down somewhere in the Southwest where it doesn't snow at Christmas? What do you communicate with? And furthermore, you've got an IQ problem in many cases as well as a cultural deprivation. So again, here there is tremendous concern. But also I think we need ecumenical cooperation before we can prepare materials that are good enough and effective enough to do the job. And one other area that concerns us with social responsibility is this whole problem of rapid social change. This affects more our missionary education, I think, than it does what's going on in this country, but it's true both places. We have yet to find out what the proper missionary education program is in Africa. I think it's important that the charismatic catechetics approach grew out of the protest of missionaries about the atrocious material being fed to Roman Catholic missionaries to use in Africa and Asia. And this led to the conference on modern catechetics that moved things in a new direction. It was the missionaries asking for help because they did not have anything that spoke to the rapid social change of emerging nationalisms. Now, the danger of such a survey as this is quite obvious, I think, that what I'm doing is hitting a lot of high spots. And I'm leaving the development of all of these ideas to others. But that's exactly what I intend to do. This is new thinking in Christian education, pointing to where sometimes the thinking hasn't gone a bit further than I'm indicating now. In other cases, some of you may know of instances that have gone beyond what I'm saying here. But there are sources, at least, for further information. There is a whole movement today toward what we might call ecumenical education. There has been for a number of years an organization known as the World Council of Christian Education and Sunday School Association. The publisher of a journal that appears, I think, in 90 to 100 different countries called World Christian Education. And it's a group that brings together Christian educators from all over the world. Last summer, for example, at Thuringen in Switzerland, they brought together educators to discuss the whole problem of curriculum and curriculum materials. And there'll be a report on that in the November-December issue that'll be off the press in 2 or 3 days of religious education. Or we had a conference in Belfast in 1962, and at that time, 81 nations were represented in a group of 350 educators talking about the problems of the communication of the Bible and sharing from all these different backgrounds and all these different religious outlooks this whole problem of what it means to communicate fate. And it was at this conference that the word dialogue got tossed around, because Reuel Howe was there in charge of one of the four major sections, and it was out of this section that came this tremendous insistence on the meaning of dialogue in Christian education. So this is not something restricted to the American scene. Ecumenical education, it seems to me, has to operate at least two different levels. One is simply to be able to impart to others what's going on.
How many of our youngsters or our adults have any real inkling of the power and the significance
of the World Council
of Churches? How many of them
really understand the ecumenical significance of the Vatican Council? Two great movements now pretty much operating side by side and saying something about the scandal of our divisions. This is one side. But this is going to mean nothing until we do a great deal more in the development of what is called grassroots ecumenicity, where we learn about the faith of others different from ourselves, where we enter into dialogue across denominational lines. And our youngsters get excited about this. If anybody's ever caught a course on comparative American religions.
And there are books on this available. This is where there is curriculum material. There's a book called The Church Across the Street, put out by the Unitarians,
who have been always concerned about this, doing a pretty good objective job at each chapter of summarizing the faith of others with whom they're not particularly sympathetic, but helping their youngsters to understand these other positions. There's that book that we printed, a series of articles from Look magazine, where a man representing one or another of the great American faith was describing his position, the position of his church. So here you had responsible reports from various theologically informed writers. And if it's written for Look magazine, your high school kids won't have any trouble understanding it. You know, this is a level just one age group above the Reader's Digest. And then there's one other exciting type of ecumenical activity available to you, but not to most of our people, and that is, of course, the Religious Education Association, which in the field of religious education has crossed these lines for 60 years. Back in 1906, there were Catholics, Protestants, and Jews on the program of the Religious Education Association. And today we actually spend a great deal of our time having Catholics reviewing Protestant books and Protestants reviewing Catholic books and Jews reviewing both and vice versa. And the only time I ever get in trouble is when I have a book by an Orthodox Jew reviewed by a Reformed Jew. Then I'm in trouble. But anything else seems to go. So here you have a multi-faith professional organization of religious educators whose dialogue is out in the open for everyone to read. And the resources of all faiths then become open to everyone. Another area of great significance in thinking about Christian education, of course, is family life. And I suppose for our purposes, we have to go back to Horace Bushnell, who in 1847 wrote many things that have been forgotten and remembered over and over since then. At Yale Divinity School, we refer to Horace Bushnell as St. Horace of Hartford. He wrote the book called Christian Nurture, which is really the Magna Carta of Christian freedom for children, and helped them to escape from all of the psychological limitations of a revivalistic theology. But the most important thing that Bushnell had to say in Christian Nurture was in terms of the ministry of parents, the ways in which parents influenced and impressed their children, not only in the early years, but all the time that these youngsters were in the home. Here was an understanding, many years before the psychologist got hold of it, of what parents do to and for their children. And when you realize the significance of the ministry of parenthood, and then examine the incompetence of most parents, it is a heartbreaking situation. For example, the Christian Faith and Life series of the Presbyterians in 1948 came out with materials for parents to use in the home that would parallel what was going on in the church school class. By the most effective count, I think 20% of these magazines got into the homes, and any kind of a survey they could get showed less than 1 or 2% of the parents even trying to use the material, and most of them unable to. So that after a few years of failure, they sent a research team out to find out what was wrong with Presbyterian parents. And there was nothing wrong with Presbyterian parents. There aren't wrong with every other brand. They just didn't know anything. They examined them on their understanding of Presbyterian theology, of the Bible, of the role of the clergyman, and the reports are just devastating. And these were Presbyterians close enough to the church to be open for research. They stayed around long enough to be researched.
When you consider how many parents are on the fringe of a church where you can't catch them at all, you realize that this was really the remarkable remnant that they were testing.
And the results were still devastating. This is a study by Fairchild and Wynn called The only place we've seen where parents can do anything has been in the area not of religious nurture, but in the area of character development,
where parents are enlisted and instructed and told what to do week by week,
and where they're told they can't keep their parents in the Sunday school unless they, the children in the Sunday school,
unless the parents cooperate, they get results. And they've been getting results in this program for 30 years. This is Dr. Ernest Ligon's character research project. Now, you might not like his theology, and you may not like his character in terms of the traits that he desires to instill in the children. The point is that what he has shown is that where parents cooperate, you can get his kinds of results, and I suppose any other kind of results as well. And this, of course, points toward a different strategy from that of putting materials in the homes of uninstructed parents. It means that the only way we're ever going to get at this problem of the development of Christian faith in the family is through the instruction and nurture of the parents as well as the children. And a great deal is being done along this line today. There are churches today that have family worshiping together in a service geared to the family. Now, this is quite different from the Middle Western and Southern practice of families going to church where the service is geared for adults. The service where I have said that the children think that all Jesus ever said was suffer the little children. It's entirely possible to have a service of worship, including the preaching, so that Johnny, age 6, responds because he's heard the story that the Bible tells, the kerygma. And I think I'm right in saying that anytime you hold Johnny's attention, you never lose a father. Now, if you can have a family service of worship that has a certain amount of genuine reality in it, then your families are drawn together in loyalty to the life of the church. It's also possible to tie in a teaching ministry with baptism and the ministry of the parents following baptism. And then, as I've already indicated, you can do a great deal with parents' classes. But as the Fairchild and Wynn study indicates, we still have a long way to go.
Another area in which a good deal of thinking is going on in Christian education is in the use of the Bible.
And I should say that almost all modern use of the Bible in Christian education is governed to a great extent by the insights of biblical theology. In other words, the Bible does not stand by itself.
It's not teaching about the Bible. It's not what you have in seminary called biblical introduction. It's biblical interpretation from a theological perspective. The Bible then is not seen as an end in itself, but the problem of Christian education is to enable the pupil to think biblically about the religious issues in his life. He learns to go to the Bible with new questions, the questions of his existence.
And because the Bible is open to him, he is able to find there something of the power and the wisdom of God. There's a change in biblical teaching from moralism or even moral guidance.
It's a kind of teaching that avoids the respectability of what we've called for many years Sunday school stuff.
This antiseptic, aseptic, sterile morality that only applies to discussions with a Sunday school teacher and never outside of class. It's recognizing that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And it means that the ethic of the Bible is not that of moralism, but of radical obedience. This kind of use of the Bible takes ethical decisions that men are faced with and places them within the framework of a view of revelation based on God's acts rather than on propositions. This does not destroy the morality based on God's law, but it provides a freedom under God's law that challenges the laws of men.
When the Bible is used this way, it may be interpreted in terms of what Rule Howe has called the language of relationships. And the biblical faith can be communicated to children long before they can use the biblical vocabulary. The story of God's engagement with men, the record of God's mighty acts in history, the drama of redemption.
And the priority is placed on God with the central act being God's incarnation in Jesus Christ. And this makes it possible for man to share in the freedom of Christ to be a new creature. Now, this is one way of viewing the Bible in current thinking. Sometimes it's done quite simply in terms of five acts of the drama of redemption, of creation, covenant, Christ, church, consummation. And every one of these five acts of the drama has an existential relationship to the life of the individual. Now, the difficulty in teaching the Bible today is, of course, that it represents a world view that is so far out of line with the way people think today. This could be developed at great length, but I think this illustrates why laymen galore find meaningful a book like Honest to God by the Bishop of Woolwich. Because Bishop Robinson somehow is asking the kinds of questions that lay people ask. And so you have 750,000 copies sold in England, but there are probably not that many people in church on Sunday. Or again, you get a book that's much milder, Bishop Pike's A Time for Candor, which is much milder than any of the publicity he's getting. But again, a book that's asking some of the right questions. And these books can be used with adults. Some of them won't like it, but that isn't the important thing about a book. The idea of a book is to get people in dialogue with each other. And these books will do that. And they will help the parents to understand how the Christian faith can be communicated in a scientific age. For our children are growing up taking for granted many things that you and I had to learn after we grew up about the modern scientific view of things. When I learned about the ascension, I didn't have the problem of John Glenn, but my grandchildren do. And if the child asks the question, how fast did Jesus go up? The answer is, but John Glenn went up faster. What do you do with that? Now, I want to get at one other very important area before I close, and that's the area of what's happening in the field of religious language. The whole problem of what we call logical empiricism. Because what I just said about the communication of the Bible involves this whole problem of understanding how we communicate religious faith, not only today, but any time. And I think we've been missing the boat on this for many years. But if we look at the development of logical empiricism from the time of Wittgenstein on, where it began as logical positivism with no interest whatever in religion, we find that as this movement has developed, particularly in British philosophy, it has taken on a number of different forms and finally has moved in the direction of asking religious questions. And the minute it does this, it begins to illuminate religious language. The most important person breaking ground here is Canon Eon T. Ramsay of Oriel College, Oxford, who says that the significance of religious development is that there is some kind of discernment. There is a moment in which there is a disclosure of God's truth, the supernatural impinging on the natural. And this comes, he says, not in any predictable way, never as a result of logic, but it comes, as we say, when the light dawns, the ice breaks. How many times we've been in dialogue with someone and we can't understand what he's talking about, and all of a sudden, for no good reason, I've got it. And the light dawns. Something has been disclosed that formerly was hidden.
And this is the essence of revelation, says Ramsay.
And the problem of religious communication is that there might be a moment of discernment which is followed by commitment.
That moment when I see an individual as a person.
Or when I see God's claim on me as a matter of obedience. Or when I get new insight and
suddenly see the meaning of that
event of yesterday that seemed so meaningless. There are all kinds of ways in which the odd logic of a religious language can cause this kind of a breakthrough. It's not a form of magic, but the logic is odd. It's not systematic. That's why no one ever gets converted by reading a book in systematic theology. There's no kerygma. The kerygma is storytelling, image thinking, oftentimes odd in its logic. For here, as I said, the supernatural is impinging on the natural. And what education does is to prepare a man to receive such a disclosure. But education can never manipulate a person so that he makes a desired response. Anyone who's ever taught a confirmation class knows this. You may manipulate them to be confirmed. You never can manipulate them so a disclosure takes place. You merely can prepare them to discern if the light's gone. So the primary purpose, says Ramsey, is to teach insight rather than information, to evoke disclosures rather than seek intellectual assent. And this is why we're helped in this if we see the special nature of religious language, which is more akin to poetry than to prose. It's tied in with story language, picture language, poetic language, never with propositions. So what Ramsey's saying, you see, is exactly what Father Sloyan has said about the kerygma coming before the catechism. Or again, it can be expressed in terms of David Hunter, who says that we begin where the people are, and our job is to equip them for a life of commitment. But this involves discernment and then freedom to decide or not to decide. It is vision plus commitment that can lead to the new creation in Jesus Christ. And the emphasis must be on dialogue, engagement, and kerygma. Now this puts a tremendous responsibility on the teacher. For only as ideas and visions are wrapped up in persons can they be delivered to other persons. This is our form of incarnation as distinct from Christ's form. And our teacher training is best centered then in the nurture of teachers, equipping them for the work of teaching by leading them in the direction of discernment and commitment. And so in conclusion, if we take this seriously, when we begin to participate in dialogue and engagement, so that we too may respond to the kerygma, that is to the story of man's redemption in Christ, we see that Christian education means telling the story of God's mighty acts in such a way that the listener participates in the dialogue and comes into an engagement with God in his daily life. And therefore he sees the meaning of his life in a new way. And he is reborn daily with Christ as he lives in community as a Christian in the world. Thank you very much.